We're talking to you about something called the planetary computer. And today I'm joined with Lucas Joppa, our chief environmental officer. Hi, Lucas.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, good. So what is a chief environmental officer?
Well, I'm probably the less interesting, less important CEO at Microsoft, but you know, I look after our rapidly growing ambitions around environmental sustainability, and particularly the way that our technologies get put to use to improve the relationship between human activities and Earth's natural systems, to ensure that we can get out ahead of issues like the growing climate crisis by ensuring that our operations are as sustainable as possible, but also that we're proactively looking at engineering and innovating new products, new solutions, proactively working with customers all around the world, using our voice on policy issues, and engaging our employees to basically maximize the efficiency of Microsoft's products in minimizing our impact on Earth's natural systems.
And yeah, and I definitely wouldn't say you're the less important CEO. I definitely think you're the most important CEO, if I may say so. So looking at your LinkedIn profile, I stalked you a little bit the other day. I can see that you've been doing this for quite a while. I think you studied ecology at university as well. I mean, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your history before Microsoft?
Yeah, I've been paying attention to environmental systems my whole life. I was a kid that grew up, you know, mostly interested in being out in the woods, maybe a little less interested in going to school. And, you know, was always just really interested in the way that environmental systems work, the way that nature worked, and the role that people have in that broader complex system. You're right, I studied wildlife ecology for undergrad or uni. As you might say in the UK, I had the privilege of spending 2 years in the Peace Corps in Malawi, before then heading off to do my PhD in ecology. And then really just went straight to Microsoft after school. So I've been at Microsoft for 10 years. I received my 10-year anniversary email this year and spent a lot of that time in Microsoft Research, our Blue Sky research arm, leading research programs at the intersection of environmental and computer science, before stepping out to take on a more corporate role as the first chief environmental officer for the company.
Fantastic. What an inspiring journey all the way through. So I want to now ask you about our latest sustainability announcement, which you made, I think, a couple of weeks, or maybe a month ago now. What is the problem that we're trying to solve with what we announced there?
Yeah, sure. And it's interesting that, you know, we can say the latest announcement, and that's just in 2020. I think it was the announcement you're referring to as our second. We came out with our first big sustainability announcement in January of this year, where we committed to being the first carbon negative company by 2030. We can go into the details of that later. I know that's not the question you asked me, but just reflecting on the timeline that Microsoft's on, we're already, you know, past our second sustainability announcement of the year, and the year is young. So the way that we think about sustainability in Microsoft is across four key areas of carbon, water, waste, and ecosystems. And it was last month in advance of Earth Day that we made our first significant commitment in the area of ecosystems. Ecosystems, biodiversity, the species that come together to support life on Earth, including human life on Earth, because it's biodiversity and the ecosystems that they create that provide all of the freely available benefits from nature to people: water filtration, air purification, the provisioning of food, timber, fibers, and all of those things. Those are all resources freely provided by nature to us to improve society and improve the overall human experience. And so what we announced back in a month ago was really a multi-prong approach to how we're going to work in ecosystems. But there's two bits that I really want to pull out of that announcement and reiterate here. The first is that Microsoft committed to being one of the first companies in the world to commit to protecting more land than we use. So admittedly, Microsoft isn't, you know, the world's largest landowner, but for the land that we own all around the world, we've summed that up and we've committed to investing both here in the United States and internationally in protecting at least that much land over the next 5 years, putting at least that much land into permanent protection. And then we stepped back and we said, well, that's good. It's good to take care of the land that we influence, but there's a bigger problem here. And the bigger problem is that this digital age, this information age, it hasn't yet really reached the aspect of how humans monitor, model, and then ultimately manage Earth's natural systems. It's very easy to find route, you know, the shortest route path to your favorite coffee shop, for instance, but we don't know how many trees there are on Earth, which is a problem because trees provide timber, but also trees will provide a path towards removing carbon from the atmosphere. And so we committed as part of this announcement to build what we're calling a planetary computer, a new platform that's dedicated to integrating extremely large global data sets about the environment, integrating that with some of Microsoft's state-of-the-art machine learning solutions, and making it very easy to spin up and down large compute jobs so that you can take ideas that you have about new algorithms for converting, you know, potentially satellite imagery into data sets about where trees or water or anything else is, and then immediately make those services available to users all around the world in the same way that we've been seeing folks do throughout this entire Build conference for the past 2 days.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's a really, really big answer to this problem, this planetary scale computer. What are the risks? What's going to stop us from getting there, from getting to that point?
Well, I think one of the biggest risks is a disconnect between the users and the developers and kind of the two types of knowledge bases that we need to bring together. You know, most of the developers attending Build this year, and the numbers, by the way, I think just stepping back, the numbers are mind-blowing. Build is bigger than anybody ever imagined. But you know, most of those developers don't come to this space with a significant background or understanding in environmental systems and environmental science and the way that their skills can be put to use in helping improve the state of the world. And most actors in the environmental sustainability space, the potential users, they're not as educated as we would like them to be about what solutions already exist or could be built to help them. And so as a company, as a platform company like Microsoft, I really see it as our job to help show the world what's possible and then use platforms like Build and all of our other events and communities that we maintain around the world to help bring those two worlds together. And, you know, that's easy to say. It's easier to do when you have a platform upon which to do it. And so that's really one of the reasons that we're building this planetary computer platform, is because when you're trying to bring these two worlds together, it makes it a lot easier when there's a common platform for those two communities to meet upon.
I see. So Raul, it's not just here's a planetary computer. There's an amount of education involved here as well, and connecting with the communities. So can you give some examples of how the planetary computer can be used?
So there's all sorts of things that I think people will find useful about what we bring out into the world. I think you know, really the ability to write code natively against large remote sensing data sets is going to be powerful. We all know that large data sets are, you know, difficult to work with unless you have everything structured exactly the way you want it. Just the simple act of moving data sets that are, you know, large enough to represent the entire world, you know, every day at high resolution, the, you know, just moving those things can be difficult. Then writing code is not necessarily the hard part, but deploying that code at scale across data sets of that size and training algorithms in performant time. I think all of those things are going to be a lot easier to do. And the applications that they open up are everything from what I would just call, you know, quantification, the what is where and how much is there around the world. How many trees are there? Where are they? What's their carbon sequestration potential? Where is the world's surface water and how fast is it being depleted? All those traditional questions that we just want to know from a monitoring perspective will be opened up. But then there's also really important work that we need to empower further down the land management chain, things like attribution. How do we allow people to statistically quantify the impact of investments that they've made to say, yes, the world is getting better, or no, it isn't as a result of the investment? And how do we plan? How do we do things like spatially constrained optimization so that we can figure out how to achieve the most with the least amount of resources? Those are things that we've seen machine learning and artificial intelligence more generally on top of scalable cloud computing platforms be able to produce in other areas. And they're applications and topics that we really want to be able to bring to bear in the sustainability space as well.
And that's a really, now that you mention it, I didn't realize, as a developer, I understand if you can't measure something, you'll never really get optimized. So we don't even really have a great way to answer the question. If we don't have a great way to answer the question, how many trees are there in the world? How do we then even know that any of our efforts to stop deforestation or afforestation is going to work? So now, yes, those are some of the applications of the planetary computer.
I mean, you think about it a lot kind of in the debugging process, right? And debugging is made a lot easier with precise and accurate telemetry. We don't have a very good telemetry system for Earth's operating system. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to get to is we know there's bugs in our code. We know that the way that human society is interacting with Earth's natural systems isn't perfect, isn't optimal. We know it's leading to deleterious outcomes. The question, though, is that by the time we get around to seeing the process to seeing the outcome, a little bit too much time has passed. And then once we realize that there is a bug, there isn't a freely available kind of code base to go back to and say, oh, well, we'll just go fix this or we'll fix that. That's still in the realm of science and much of it of how the world works. But being able to start bringing this together in a scalable platform so that we can get into much more near real time between the science and the outcomes and then kind of the code that connects those things, I think the better will be. I don't imagine there's many developers that would be happy if we just took away their entire development and debugging environment, built an extremely complex system, and then told them to go fix what was broken when they find out 2 months from now.
I absolutely love that explanation. I think you've nailed it perfectly for this audience, Lucas. Brilliant. So how can people, I mean, now this is amazing. We've got this planetary computer, or we're launching this planetary computer. If there's somebody listening to this stream right now, how can they get access? How can they get involved?
So first thing that I would say is the planetary computer actually came out of a program that we launched a little over 2 years ago called AI for Earth. And AI for Earth was a five-year, $50 million investment that Microsoft made in deploying machine learning resources in the areas of carbon, water, agriculture, and climate. And when we launched that program, it was the first of its kind. It has since then become a bit of a template for Microsoft's other AI for Good initiatives. But it also was just starting from absolutely nothing. We had to go out and learn what the community's problems were. We had to build a global community. And then we had to figure out what's the most precise way for Microsoft to get involved from a technology perspective, other than just providing freely available, cloud technologies to organizations. What unique additional contribution can we make? And so when we started out, as I said, we had nothing. We're now supporting more than 500 grantees in more than 85 countries around the world. And the Planetary Computer, really, the idea of it has come from that community, has come from those conversations about the way that Microsoft can get involved. And so what I would like to do is to ensure that, you know, as people get this idea of a planetary computer, what it could be and maybe what it should be, that we continue to use that AI for Earth community and that AI for Earth program as an ingest kind of function to our ideation. And so I'd encourage everybody to go and check out the AI for Earth program. There's easy ways on our website to get in touch. There's easy ways to apply for free resources to get started on building applications. And that's really where everything starts from ideas to implementation in the planetary computer kind of world. And when, the question around when and how people can get access to it, that's the easiest way through. And then the last thing I would just say to put a pin on it is that we're just really in many ways getting started. Our announcement was a commitment to go and do this. I think you'll see, within the next year, us showing a lot of the early but significant work that we will have to show. So stay tuned and get involved through the AI First community. That's a critical first step.
I think there's some interesting hints there for what might be coming along later on in the year. I'm certainly very excited to be part of this company and to see what we're doing there. Seeing that we've got some time right now, I'd actually love to dig into a little bit into what you mentioned before, which is our first announcement, our earlier announcement that we made in this year. What we've just been talking about so far is our second announcement of the year, which, you're right, it's kind of blowing my mind a little bit. I remember when it was announced, I was actually at a climate conference, and I just had to sit down, take a moment. Everybody was talking about it. So yeah, can you just talk to us through about the first announcement that we made earlier on this year?
Yeah, and I to back into that, I went straight from making that announcement to Davos, to the World Economic Forum, and it was so strange to be there and hear everybody talking about the announcement that we just made. I kind of had that similar, like, I'm just going to sit down and hope nobody notices me. And the reason everybody was talking about it, I think, is because what Microsoft did is really upped the level of ambition for corporates in the climate space. And it was the result of a process of stepping back and looking at the past 10 years of investments that we've made in sustainability and acknowledging that we're quite proud of what we've done. We've been consistently a leader in this space. But if you're reading the most, recent best available international science, which I'm sure they were talking about at the climate conference you were at, the story is that nobody's doing enough. It doesn't matter if you're a leader or a laggard, you're not doing enough. And so what we did is we went back to the science and we said, what is the science saying that we need to do? And what the science is saying is that the world needs to achieve a net zero carbon economy by 2050. We need to balance our carbon portfolio by 2050 if we want to avert the worst socioeconomic and environmental impacts of a rapidly changing climate. And so when we looked at that, we said, okay, well, we need to do that. obviously everybody needs to do it, so we need to do it. But we also need to recognize that those companies that have more resources should probably do more. And achieving a net zero carbon economy is difficult. So some and it's going to be extremely difficult for certain organizations. So those organizations that can do more should do more. And we said, well, what is doing more? And for us, that was where we came on down on that, was to become a carbon negative company. So what we mean by that is that by 2030, we will reduce our carbon emissions by half, and then we will remove the rest. And then we added two more components to our commitment. We said, look, we're not just going to balance out our books on a year-by-year basis by going a little bit below zero. After 2030, we're going to keep doing what we've been doing, but we're also going to start reaching back in time to remove as much carbon as Microsoft has emitted since we were founded in 1975. And then to say, look, we are aware, again, that Microsoft is a bit of a special company with the size, scale, and scope of our resources that we have. And if we can achieve these goals, but nobody else can follow in our footsteps, then that's not a win for us, and it's not a win for society. And so we put in place a fund that we called the Climate Innovation Fund, $1 billion investment vehicle to, in large part, invest in carbon reduction and removal technologies to ensure that the scale of availability of these technologies is drastically increased and the cost is drastically decreased. And so that's kind of the three parts of the commitment, you know, but there's incredible details underneath all of that, moving to 100% renewable energy for our global business operations by 2025, completely electrifying our campus fleets, deploying our internal carbon fee to cover our scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. So the emissions we directly that result from our direct energy production, those emissions associated with the electricity we consume, and then the emissions from our upstream and downstream supply and value chains. And so we have a lot of work ahead of us, but I'm convinced that we're going to do it. We're going to do it well with some hiccups along the way, and that all of our customers and the developers that rely on our platforms, they're going to get almost default out of the box benefits, climate benefits, from working on our platform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I always have to always like to explain, I like to peel the onion of our announcements, because they've always got so many layers inside them. And the one you just mentioned just now with the scope 3, I think you brushed over it, which is that most people don't include scope 3, or scope 3 is not necessarily always included when people say we're going to be carbon neutral. But what we're doing is, and I love the fact that we did it, we said, forget about this. Where do you draw the boundary of what is? We're just going to say all of it. And the all of it is actually huge. It's really big.
Oh,
it's like
for
our
sure.
Scope 3 is, I can't remember, I think it's 12 million tons a year is our scope 3, I think, or 4 million is scope 2, and our 100,000 is scope 1. And to be carbon neutral, you just have to say your scope 1, your scope 2, and a bit of your scope 3. So we just said, let's stop having these arguments about where to draw the line. Boom, it's all of it.
Yeah, I think now's the time to go big on the climate battle. I think incrementalism is important as you meet big goals, but incrementalism is no longer appropriate for the way that we think about addressing the issue. And yeah, I kind of glossed over scope 3 because so many people's eyes start to glaze over as soon as you talk about it. But I think, you know, one way that I like to think about it is Microsoft's been a carbon neutral company since 2012, really, because, and we focused on our scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, and then business air travel of our scope 3. But one of the things that we stepped back and asked ourselves is that enough? And I think the clear answer inside the company was no, we need to include our full portfolio of carbon emissions. And so that's what we did. I think in the climate community and the carbon accounting community, you know, that was probably the biggest part of Microsoft's commitments that we made. Extremely ambitious, one that keeps me up at night thinking about the scale of the challenge ahead, but one that I'm excited to go out and get after, because it's the thing we have to do.
Yeah, we need the, as you said, with the planetary computer, we need a planet scale computer to solve these challenges. These are big challenges, and we need to do big things to solve them. If we only do a little, we'll only achieve a little, which is a quote I read a while ago. We've got a little bit of time, and there's some questions from the audience I might just throw in your direction. So very, very quickly, so Bill is saying, congratulations on leading sustainability. Are you planning to collaborate with other companies to help instill renewable energy and sustainability best practices across all industries? And we are doing amazing stuff here. Are we working, are we helping teach that to others?
We are, yeah. I was on a call this morning with an important customer. I'm on calls, unfortunately calls, and not in person, because I do love spending time with customers around the world. But discussing exactly this, we spend a lot of time as a company educating on our best practices, learning from best practices of our customers, because look, Microsoft does not have this all figured out. There's a lot of other companies that have been working in this space as well, and have done a lot of great work that we as a company need to learn from. And then I think that there's going to be a lot of benefit in Microsoft joining forces with coalitions of customers that represent different industries to really start to develop that private sector best practice, because some of these areas are still really kind of poorly defined. You know, phrases like net zero isn't a phrase that has a proper accounting yet behind it. So I think that there's a lot of opportunities for Microsoft and a lot of our leading customers in other sectors to come together to really hash some of this stuff out.
And that's it. That's all we have time for today, Lucas. Thank you so much for your time today in this call, and also for everything that you're doing for Microsoft and for the world beyond. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on here. I really appreciate it. And best of luck for the rest of the build.
Cheers. Bye.